be continuing our series as we just explore the life of Jesus, looking at today chapter, John chapter 7, as we just look into the life of Jesus. And there's one of the things that I found as I explore the scripture, especially as I explore the life of Jesus, there are parts of it that get really frustrating because there's a whole bunch of details that I wish the writers filled in. Because it's like, well, what about this? As you explore a chapter, as you explore a section, as they're talking about some of the events going on, you're like, well, what about this? Or what was this person doing? Or what were they thinking? Or how did this get resolved? There's all these questions that I'm left with that unfortunately or frustratingly are not answered. Now, John covers it in his letter in like around chapter 20. He just said, hey, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that Jesus did, a whole bunch of other stuff that he taught, a whole bunch of other miracles that he did, but I don't have space to share all of that. I have a focus here where the stuff I write is to help you to really understand who Jesus is so you can put your faith in him and believe in him and become a follower of him. So it's like the writer has to limit the scope, and it gets a little frustrating at times because I want those details. And so today, as we explore John chapter 7, the first part, Jesus is getting ready. There's a big festival that's taking place, the festival of tabernacles or booths or shelters. And basically, it's their fall harvest festival. And it's one of their three big festivals that their culture did every year. At the beginning of the year in the spring is Passover, then was it 50 days later? It's Pentecost. And then all the way around to about the half year mark on the other side of things, it's the Festival of Tabernacles or booths or shelters or tents. So it's this festival there that happens. And so there's this time jump that occurs when we look at John chapter 6 all the way to John chapter 7. About 6 months has passed by because the focus of John chapter 6 is what happened at the Passover. And so it jumps to now approaching this festival. And so in that, as we look at it, there is this relational tension that you notice between Jesus and his family. And we're going to take a little bit of time to look at that today of relational tension. How do I navigate relational tension in a way that honors God and values people? So we're going to kind of explore that in a minute. But let's just look at what happens in John chapter 7, starting at verse 1. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So we know 6 months has passed. Jesus now, if you remember in John chapter 6, as we explored that, some amazing things happened as far as Jesus fed the multitude. He fed about 15,000 people. He walks on water. Peter follows him. It's a great thing. Then everybody comes to find Jesus, and then he talks about how he's the bread of life. And then through that discourse, his following fell apart. He went from large crowds being around him to now a very small select group of people that were sticking with him. And then Jesus tended to stay away from Jerusalem, which was the center of their Jewish culture, of their power. Politics of just their nation. It was their New York City, their Chicago, their Los Angeles. He's tended to stay away from there, stayed out in the country. In fact, the way that Israel was divided into kind of two political areas, Judea and Galilee, he just kind of stayed in Galilee where it was a little bit safer for him to be. So he is just outside of the big city. He's ministering to a small group of people, pouring into them. His following has begun to disintegrate as he's now focused on, I have to pour into my core because the whole church after my death and resurrection depends on this group of people getting it. Now, they don't understand anything of this. They learn all that after the fact. We learn that all after the fact. In the midst of it, they're like, what is happening? Jesus is hiding out. The crowds are falling apart and there's this tension forming. So, here's Jesus, and he's hanging out. He's away from everything. Now, we do know that the religious leaders are still out to eliminate him. Here it is. He doesn't have the big crowds anymore. But the religious leaders, the political leaders of their day, are out to get him. Now, when we look at that, we're like, religious leaders were out to get him? Because in our culture, we have this division between government and religion. In the Jewish culture at that time, they were kind of connected together. And so when we read it from our eyes, we're like, well, yeah, freedom of religion. And you have that division. For them, everything was kind of interconnected. And so here it is, you have this group of people that they're like, we want to take Jesus out. We don't care that the crowds are following because some of the things that Jesus said were controversial. They didn't like the things that he was saying. He gets up and he says, hey, I'm the Son of God. And they're like, that is blasphemy. That is heresy. That is wrong. And so they're going like, okay, we know our scriptures. And they're looking for everything they find against him. And they're like, hey, Deuteronomy 13, he's a false prophet. What's the penalty for being a false prophet? Capital punishment, execution, death. So they're like, we're taking him out. So they didn't like the things he was saying. And then Jesus had a tendency to really point out hypocrisy. And who did he direct it at? A lot of the religious leaders. Does anybody like their sin being exposed? Absolutely no one. And they're like, hey, we have power to cause him to be quiet. So there's this tension that's forming. And so the religious leaders are like, we don't like this Jesus character. So you have that tension forming. You have that relationship tension there. And then his brothers taking place. And so the big festival comes up. It's a joyous festival. It's an 8-day event. And I think it's exciting for two reasons. One, it's a massive camp out. Because they're like, we're going to go and we're going to set up tents, booths, shelters, tabernacles. We're going to set up little temporary dwelling places all around the city. Now, many of the houses had flat roofs, so they'd put tents up on top of the roofs. So you had alleyways filled with tents because it was a festival that everybody came back to town for. In fact, whole villages would leave and go into Jerusalem for this. So imagine what it's like. It's just tents everywhere. It's this big, joyous affair as they do that. So it's like, hey, we're going to go have fun. It's going to be a great time. We're having a camp out. We're making s'mores every night. It was like a big thing there. And so for one thing, they were remembering, the part of the focus was remembering how God had taken care of the Israelites when he rescued them from Egyptian captivity. And for 40 years, they walked in the wilderness and how God provided for them while they lived in temporary dwellings. So they're reflecting back. Oh, look at what God did for us. Then they're also celebrating the harvest because they're just like, hey, we had a great year this year. We had a great crop this year. We were able to harvest grapes and make wine. We were able to do the other crops that we harvest. So they're celebrating. So think about how joyous that is because one, they're like, hey, we're done with all the work. We've did all the planting, all the weeding, all the everything you do with a crop. Now we've harvested it and we've sold it or we've stored it away. And so now we can kick back for a while before we got to start over. So one part, they're just like, hey, this is joyous. And look how God blessed me with this. Then also on top of that, because many of them were farmers and had that agricultural lifestyle, they now have big paychecks because they were able to sell that product. And so they have big fat wallets. So they're in a better mood because, hey, aren't we all in a better mood on payday than we are after we have to pay all the bills? Because that Thursday before Friday payday, you're just like, oh, how are we going to make it one more day? And then payday comes, you're like, hey, we're flush with cash. We're going out to eat tonight, everybody. And hey, I'm feeling really generous. One of you can get a soft drink. Everybody else just water. But so they're getting ready to go to the festival. So his brothers come to him in verse 3, and they're like, so his brother said to him, leave here and go to Judea that your disciples may also see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers believed in him. Now here's the tension that's beginning to form. Because his brothers are like, we want you to go get out of the country, go back to the city. Because 6 months ago, you had a large crowd of people that were following you. So you go back to the city, you go back to where everybody is, and you start doing miracles and you start rebuilding your following. We need the crowds back. Because to them, they don't believe in who he is, but they see him being this teacher. They see him being inspirational. They see him do so much that he's doing. And to them, they're like, when you have this big following that suddenly crumbles to nothing, then you're dishonoring our family name. And we don't like our family name being dragged through the mud. We wanted our family name to be successful and to look good. And so we want you to rebuild this following so that we all look good again. So there's that tension that's there. Then they're also like, we want you to go because everything that you're doing when you're out in obscurity, then it's considered deceitful in our culture, but because if you're really right in what you're doing, you should be out in the crowds and you should be out openly doing things. If you're hidden away, then it's deceitful, and we want you to be out in the open proclaiming what you're proclaiming. But that tension is there, and they don't even believe in who he is. Can you imagine that tension in that house? Imagine the stories when their mom just shares about her experiences when she was a teenager and how God worked and moved and the whole situation of how Jesus is born and how God provided for Mary and Joseph and Jesus for the first couple years of their life and all that they experienced. And the brothers just sitting there and the sisters just sitting there going, Mom, that's crazy. And I'm sure there was this little bit of aspect where Jesus was just Mary's favorite child. I mean, how could he not be? Just with the experience that she had, and then with the character of who he was. And so you have that tension that's under the surface there between the family being like, hey, you need to go and rebuild your following. You need to go do this. You need to quit hiding away. You need to get to that festival right now. That tension. Now, his brothers probably didn't understand the whole dynamics of everything that's going on. They don't really understand the theological issues that are taking place. They don't understand what Jesus' true mission, and in fact, nobody was really grasping it. Even the people that were closest to him were missing what Jesus was trying to accomplish. So there's that tension there. They didn't understand his mission. To them, Jesus' success was measured in the size of the crowds. To Jesus, his success was giving his life as a sacrifice for the forgiveness of sins and the salvation of people. Here's the really cool part, though. They eventually came to believe him and who he was. I love how James's brother opens his letter to the Christians years later. He says this in James 1:1, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. I mean, to say Lord, he's to say one in authority. Now, how many younger siblings ever want to say that about their older sibling? Hey, my older sibling's an authority. No younger sibling ever wants to say that. I have 3 children at home. My younger 2 do not like it when the oldest one shows some level of older brother authority. The younger ones are like, who does he think he is? And one of the children will constantly respond to him and say, okay, Dad. Nobody, when you're sitting there like that, you're just like, so James is just like, the Lord, the one in authority. I'm submitting to him. And then he follows it up. Not the Lord Jesus, my brother. It's the Lord Jesus Christ. Christ, the Messiah. Christ, the Holy One. Christ, the promised one from God. He realizes that. It comes to his understanding. Now, it took a while to get there. That's why don't give up when you're dealing with unbelieving family members. Because in their familiarity with you, it takes longer for what you're sharing with them to get through their thick skulls. Because familiarity is hard to get around. So his brothers are always around Jesus. They grew up with Jesus. They were compared to who Jesus was. They had all that tension growing up just being siblings. So it takes a little bit longer for things to sink in. So don't give up. So that tension's forming. But Jesus, here's the really neat thing. The brothers are like, you go. You rebuild. And how many of us, you know, all of us have different personalities. And so some are more easily manipulated and pushed around than other people. Some people, you know, you tell them what to do and their response is absolutely not doing it. Your guaranteed way to get them to do something is not to tell them to do it, because the minute you tell them to do it, they're like super stubborn, comes out of them. You met those people before? And then you have other people that you can just look at them a little bit stern, and they're like, okay, I'm doing it. Okay, I can take care of it. Let me do it. You know, you have that. I love this about Jesus, because he remains obediently focused. Verse 6, Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to the feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee. Jesus operated on his own terms, not the demands of his siblings. He may have responded to the request eventually, just like he did with his mom when she's just like, "Hey, Jesus, we got this problem. We're at this wedding. There's this festival taking place. They ran out of wine to serve the guests. They're going to be humiliated. You do something about it." Jesus didn't even immediately respond to her. He's like, "Hey, why are you involving me in this? My time has not yet come." Why? What does that mean? Jesus is focused on the cross. His mission is the cross. Anything else that he gets there has to be purposeful to get him to that cross. If he goes up into town at the wrong time, to the wrong festival, at the wrong time of year, it messes up his destiny of the cross. He has to get to that place because the salvation of humanity depends upon it. That's his focus. So he's just like, "I have to get to that point. You want me to go now? I can't, because if I go now, they're going to find me, arrest me. It's going to mess everything up with God's plans, because my death and resurrection are really symbolic of what God did with the Passover. And so it needs to all be interconnected." So Jesus remains obediently focused. He remains completely obedient to the Father's leading. He just lived an obedient, trusting, faith-filled life with the Father God, resulting in a purposeful life. His brothers just did what they want. So he calls them, "Hey, you're not a threat to the world, because you just live your life doing whatever you want with no real purpose." Whereas Jesus is like, "I'm a complete threat to the world because I am walking in perfect obedience to the Father, and I am a threat to the kingdom of evil." So there's that tension that's forming. So his brothers leave. They go off to the festival. And then verse 10 focuses on that first opening of the festival, and I can just see what's happening. As people are coming in, I can just see all the religious leaders, all the political leaders that are looking for Jesus to take him out are just like, "You get somebody by that area, you have somebody by that area, you have somebody by that area." Because a pious person, a religious person, somebody that's really striving to be right with our Jewish faith will be at this festival at the right time. They will be here for the entire 8 days. They will be here from opening ceremony to closing ceremony to sweeping the streets, throwing the trash away, taking it out to the dump. They will be here. Why? Because they're like, "Hey, we're the super elite religious people, and we're here from beginning to end. Therefore, a person that's really right with God will be here for a festival they're supposed to be at from beginning to end, especially when they live close enough to get here." So they're like expecting in verse 10. "But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, they also went up, not publicly, but in private." Or he also went up, not publicly, but in private. "The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, 'Where is he?' And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, 'He is a good man,' others said, 'No, he is leading the people astray.' Yet for the fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him." I mean, they're ready to take Jesus out. So Jesus doesn't come walking in when they expect him, so that just kind of falls apart, and they're probably just like, "Hey, we watched all day, boss. He's not coming. He's hiding. He's afraid of us." And so they just kind of disperse, and at some point, Jesus comes in there. Now, the one thing we have to realize is Jesus was most likely very ordinary looking. Now, in our minds, we're just like, hey, we see that picture that they have of him where he looks like this kind of European, really handsome European guy with this really long flowing hair. And as he's walking in, there's like a glow that's always around him that's just following everywhere he is. That it's just like, you could look at a crowd of people like, well, there he is. Look at him. It's like Brad Pitt walking amongst the crowd. He's just like this really good looking guy. And there's a glow around him. And he just stands out in the crowd like God just took a big highlighter and highlighted him. And that's probably not really how it was. He was probably just very average looking in their culture, with long, very curly hair, with a full, curly, messy beard, probably with dark skin, and just blended right in the crowd. In fact, the religion, and we didn't have photos and videos to really point him out in that time. Now we'd have like 8,000, I mean, Jesus, everything Jesus would do, there'd be video and photos of it on every social media thing ever. So you'd always know what he looks like. They don't have that then. So it's like they have to rely on somebody to turn him in to actually point exactly who he is out when they arrest him 6 months later. It requires Judas to just be like, no, this is Jesus right here. This guy right here. Not this one, this one, this one around him. It's this guy right here. I'll prove it by kissing him on the cheek. So he can just kind of come in, and it's not this, oh, angelic procession singing as he walks, the crowd just naturally parting. And so Jesus just shows up at the crowd, and next week we'll explore it a little bit more of the things that happen at the event. But let's kind of step back and look at some of the relational tension real quick. Because one of the things we want to do when we're facing relational tension is be the one you want others to be for you. So start by being patient, because you don't know all the details about the person's life or situation. Be patient. Jesus' brothers could not comprehend his mission or his purpose. They couldn't grasp it. It didn't make sense to them, so they didn't know all the details. All of us have different life experiences, both good and bad. And you realize this sometimes when you get married and you realize, wow, you not only marry the person, you marry all of their experiences to the point that you got married. Or when you make friends with somebody, you not only become friends with them, but you become friends with them with all their good and bad experiences that they've ever had up until that point. So we always don't know the history, the different life experiences, the different ways that people look at things. We don't always know their thought life, what their hopes, their dreams, their imaginations, their insecurities. We don't always know what their thought lives are like. So be patient. And then, if we're going to be honest, we all have different personality types. I mean, on one hand, you have introverts and you have extroverts. Introverts make up about a third of people, extroverts, two-thirds of people. Then you have all these other personality breakdowns as you look at different people. And everybody within their personality thinks, everybody else thinks exactly the way they think. Even though a different personality processes things differently, but we don't realize it because we're like, well, I think this way, therefore everybody should think this way because how I think is right. And then that person over here is like, how I think is right, so everybody else should think the way I think. And so sometimes when we're getting frustrated with people and we're like, what were you thinking? They're like, I was thinking what was right. What were you thinking? And then you're like, no, I was thinking what was right. What were you thinking? And it's that tension sometimes that we don't even look at how the different personality types impact each other. Because some personality types are more drawn to each other. Some personality types are more naturally like, takes a little more grace to be around you. So we have to learn to be patient with each other. Then, not only that, we have to choose who controls us. I love this because Jesus' motivation was, I choose to allow Father God to control my decisions. He's like, I'm not going up to Jerusalem to the festival until the Father tells me to go. Until then, I stay put. Whereas brothers are like, no, you go now. You go do this now. Jesus is like, I'm not going to fall into peer pressure. I'm choosing who controls what I do. So a lot of times in our relationships with people, we need to choose who controls us. We need to choose the thoughts we have about individuals. We need to choose what we allow to just stay in our mind. We need to choose that wisely. Then we need to keep the big picture in mind of the relationship. Where's this friendship going? If we cause a bunch of problems now, if we don't reconcile, if we don't work through this, what is the end result? Jesus is like, I have to be very careful how I navigate this situation because I want every single person in the world to come to faith in me. But also, I want my brothers to come into faith in me too. I don't want them to miss out just because of their familiarity with me. So Jesus is keeping that in mind. He's like, hey, I'll go to the festival, but my time's not right now. I'll go when the Father directs me to go. We got to keep the big picture in mind in our relationships. And I love this, stealing from Royal Rangers, we got to make the golden rule our daily rule. Matthew 7:12, do to others whatever you would like them to do to you. This is the essence of all that is taught in the law and the prophets. I mean, how I treat people is so important. So this comes to the idea of be the person you want others to be for you. So be the friend you want others to be friends like to you. Be the helper you want others to help you with. Be the worker of how you want other people to work. Be that person of who you want other people to emulate around you. Be that person. Be the friend, be the helper, be the parent, be the spouse, be the worker, and so on that you want others to be for you. And then honor people because everyone matters to God. To honor is to treat with high regard or great respect. It's to value someone. Now, valuing someone is not the same as accepting sinful behavior. I might value you because you matter to God and you're important. That doesn't mean I accept the behavior of what you do. But to value them means that I love you enough that I'm going to lovingly and gracefully share with you the truth so that the things that you do that are destructive, the things that you do that are wrong, the things that you do that are going to cause you to miss out on knowing God, the things that you do that cause there to be relational tension, I'm going to work with you through those because you matter to God and you matter to me. You are valuable and irreplaceable, so I'm going to take the time to help you. Now, a lot of times we just don't value people because we just want to point out everything that they do wrong, but we don't value them enough to listen to them, to talk to them, to help them, to be with them, to walk with them through things. But if I'm going to really work through relational tension and not cause it, I need to value people because everyone matters to God. So it really means some simple things. I build up over tearing them down. I believe the best about them instead of assuming the worst. I ask them questions over assuming responses. I inquire over imagining. Because I'll always find what I'm looking for in a person. If I want to find fault, I will always find fault in a person. I will always find what I'm looking for. And if I don't ask questions, I'm always going to fill in everything with my imagination. And if I've already determined, hey, I don't really like you, then if I don't get to know you, if I don't take time to talk to you, if I don't take time to ask questions and inquire about things, I'm just going to imagine all the details to fill everything in to come back to my presupposition of I just don't like you. So I take time to ask questions. I take time to inquire. I take time to learn about the person. I let go of, I forgive over holding on to things. I let go of things. I don't hold on to them. I keep short records. I keep short accounts. I don't sit there and rehash things that happened a long time ago. I let go of it. I forgive. I don't allow bitterness to take place. I reconcile over taking revenge. I restore over rejecting. I cheer over criticizing. I celebrate over comparing. Because, hey, if I have a critical spirit, I'll always find fault in something or someone. I honor over degrading. I put time in over taking time out. I get close. Hey, one of the best ways we can end relational tension is just spend time with people where we just genuinely want to be around them. Because as we take time just to be around them, as we take time to talk, as we take time just to be around each other, it can just begin to allow healing to take place as we're just open and we're just talking about things and we're just doing life together. Or sometimes it can just be, hey, do a project together. You know what? And one project could be, you know, if you have some tension with somebody, just bring them out Friday night when we wipe down the building. Just do a project together, because there's something about when you're doing something else together that it allows, it's this weird way that healing can take place while you're doing something else, and you can just be talking, hey, let's do this together, help me out here, and all of a sudden you're just talking, and all of a sudden that whole barrier just begins to fall apart. But what about when I have legitimate hurts, or maybe perceived hurts? What do I do then when there's those hurts that are there? What do I do when I don't like how what that person did impacted me? It hurts me. What do I do then? Well, then you just work through the issue and you deal with it. You have some conversations. Maybe it's just a conversation with God. God, I just need to pray about this and let go of it. Maybe it's a conversation with that person and begin to work through it, because your goal is a restorative healing. So you work through it. Maybe it's you talk to somebody that's a trusted individual, not talk to everybody because that's gossip, but talk to a trusted individual to get wisdom on how to navigate the situation. But don't leave things broken. Don't leave things where you have bitterness, but come to a place of being able to truly forgive, where you're not holding on to things anymore. Because the end result is you don't want there to be anything in the way of anybody that would keep them from being with God forever. Because relationships with people are temporary. They really are. They might be large portions of your life, but they're really temporary in the great scheme of eternity. And there's some relationships with people that will consume more of your life. Like my wife and I, that relationship will consume most of our lives. But relationships with my neighbors might only be for a few years while we're next door to each other. So the relationships are different. But our ultimate goal has to be, I want to see this person shouting praise to Jesus when I'm in heaven shouting praises to Jesus too. So I'm going to deal with the tension so that I make sure there's not anything that would be in the way of that person being right with Jesus. Because I want them to connect with him. And I'm going to make sure, hey, I'm going to make sure there's not anything in me that is going to keep me from being with Jesus either. I'm not going to allow anything in me that's going to slow me down from accomplishing everything God has for me to do in my life. I'm not going to allow anything in me that causes me to wake up all frustrated and mad in the middle of the night because I'm mad at this person. I'm not going to allow that to be there. I'm not going to allow there to be things in me that when I see that person at Walmart or Target or somewhere that I turn and duck around another aisle because I don't want to see that person. I'm not going to be that person when I go to work or wherever I am where I avoid having to interact with that person at all costs, because I'm not going to allow anything in me that would keep my heart from being close to my Jesus, where he has all of my attention, all of my focus, all of my love, and there's nothing in there that would contaminate that. So I'm going to be the one that I want others to be to me. I'm gonna be the one that forgives. I'm gonna be the one that restores. I'm gonna be the one that loves. I'm gonna be the one that serves. I'm gonna be the one that's generous. I'm gonna be the one that's helpful. I'm gonna be the one that's trustworthy. I'm gonna be that one for them, even if they don't respond in kind, because I wanna honor my Jesus.